The sixth night. The dreams of the rich and the dreams of the poor, they never overlap, do they? See, the poor dream all their lives of getting enough to eat and looking like the rich. And what do the rich dream of? Losing weight and looking like the poor. Every evening, the compound around Buckingham Towers B block becomes an exercise ground. Plump, paunchy men and even plumper, paunchier women with big circles of sweat below their arms are doing their evening walking. See, with all these late-night parties, all that drinking and munching, the rich tend to get fat in Delhi, so they walk to lose weight. Now, where should a human being walk? In the outdoors, by a river, inside a park, around a forest. However, displaying their usual genius for town planning, the rich of Delhi had built this part of Gurgaon with no parks, lawns or playgrounds. It was just buildings, shopping malls, hotels, and more buildings. There was a pavement outside, but that was for the poor to live on. So if you wanted to do some walking, it had to be done around the concrete compound of your own building. Now, while they walked around the apartment block, the fatsos made their thin servants, most of them drivers, stand at various spots on that circle with bottles of mineral water and fresh towels in their hands. Each time they completed a circuit around the building, they stopped next to their man, grabbed the bottle, gulp, grabbed the towel, wipe, wipe. Then it was off on round two. Vitiligo Lips was standing in one corner of the compound with his bottle and his master's sweaty towel. Every few minutes, he turned to me with a twinkle in his eyes. His boss, the steel man, who was bald until 2 weeks ago, now sported a head of thick black hair, an expensive toupee job he had gone all the way to England for. This toupee was the main subject of discussion in the monkey circle these days. The other drivers had offered Vitiligo Lips 10 rupees to resort to the old tricks of braking unexpectedly or taking the car full speed over a pothole to knock over his master's toupee at least once. The secrets of their masters were spilled and dissected every evening by the monkey circle, though if any of them made the divorce a topic of discussion, he knew he would have to deal with me. On Mr. Ashok's privacy, I allowed no one to infringe. I was standing just a few feet from Vitiligo Lips, with my master's bottle of mineral water in my hand and his sweat-stained towel on my shoulder. Mr. Ashok was about to complete his circle. I could smell his sweat coming toward me. This was round number three for him. He took the bottle, drained it, wiped his face with his towel, and draped it back on my shoulder. "I'm done, Balram. Bring the towel and bottle up, okay?" "Yes, sir," I said, and watched him go into the apartment block. He took a walk once or twice a week, but it clearly wasn't enough to counter his nights of debauchery. I saw a big wet paunch pressing against his white T-shirt. How repulsive he was these days. I signalled to Vitiligo Lips before going down to the parking lot. 10 minutes later, I smelled the steel man's sweat and heard footsteps. Vitiligo Lips had come down. I called him over to the Honda City. It was the only place in the world I felt fully safe anymore. "What is it, Country Mouse? Want another magazine?" "Not that. Something else." I got down on my haunches. I squatted by one of the tires of the City. I scraped the grooves of the tire with a fingernail. He squatted too. I showed him the strand of golden hair. I kept it tied around my wrist like a locket. He brought my wrist to his nose. He rubbed the strand between his fingers, sniffed it, and let my wrist down. "No problem," he winked. "I told you your master would get lonely." "Don't talk about him." I seized his neck. He shook me off. "Are you crazy? You tried to choke me." I scraped the grooves of the tire again. "How much will it cost? High class or low class? Virgin or non-virgin? All depends." "I don't care. She just has to have golden hair, like in the shampoo advertisements." "Cheapest is 10,000-12,000. "That's too much. He won't pay more than 4,700. 6,500, Country Mouse. That's the minimum. White skin has to be respected." "All right." When does he want it, Country Mouse?
I'll tell you. It'll be soon.
And another thing. I want to know another thing. I put my face on the tire and breathed in the smell of the leather. For strength. How many ways are there for a driver to cheat his master? Mr. Jabbaw, I am aware that it is a common feature of those cellophane-wrapped business books to feature small sidebars. At this stage of the story, to relieve you of tedium, I would like to insert my own sidebar into the narrative of the modern entrepreneur's growth and development. How does the enterprising driver earn a little extra cash? 1. When his master is not around, he can siphon petrol from the car with a funnel, then sell the petrol. When his master orders him to make a repair to the car, he can go to a corrupt mechanic. The mechanic will inflate the price of the repair, and the driver will receive a cut. This is a list of a few entrepreneurial mechanics who help entrepreneurial drivers. Lucky Mechanics in Lado Serai, near the Kutub. RV Repairs in Greater Kailash Part 2. Nilofar Mechanics in DLF Phase 1 in Gurgaon. 3. He should study his master's habits and then ask himself, is my master careless? If so, what are the ways in which I can benefit from his carelessness? For instance, if his master leaves empty English liquor bottles lying around in the car, he can sell the whiskey bottles to the bootleggers. Johnny Walker Black brings the best resale value. 4. As he gains in experience and confidence, and is ready to try something riskier, he can turn his master's car into a freelance taxi. The stretch of the road from Gurgaon to Delhi is excellent for this. Lots of Romeos come to see their girlfriends who work in the call centers. Once the entrepreneurial driver is sure that his master is not going to notice the absence of the car, and that none of his master's friends are likely to be on the road at this time, he can spend his free time cruising around, picking up and dropping off paying customers. At night, I lay in my mosquito net, the light bulb on in my room, and watch the dark roaches crawling on top of the net, their antennae quivering and trembling, like bits of my own nerves. And I lay in bed, too agitated even to reach out and crush them. A cockroach flew down and landed right above my head. You should have asked them for money when they made you sign that thing. Enough money to sleep with 20 white-skinned girls. It flew away. Another landed on the same spot. 20? 100, 200, 300, 1,000, 10,000 golden-haired whores, and even that would still not have been enough. That would not start to be enough. Over the next 2 weeks, I did things I am still ashamed to admit. I cheated my employer. I siphoned his petrol. I took his car to a corrupt mechanic who billed him for work that was not necessary. And 3 times, while driving back to Buckingham B, I picked up a paying customer. The strangest thing was that each time I looked at the cash I had made by cheating him, instead of guilt, what did I feel? Rage. The more I stole from him, the more I realized how much he had stolen from me. To go back to the analogy I used when describing Indian politics to you earlier, I was growing a belly at last. Then one Sunday afternoon, when Mr. Ashok had said he wouldn't need me again that day, I gulped 2 big glasses of whiskey for courage, then went to the servants' dormitory. Vitiligo Lips was sitting beneath the poster of a film actress. Each time his master hammered an actress, he put her poster up on the wall, playing cards with the other drivers. "Well, you can say what you want, but I know that these jokers aren't going to win re-election." He looked up and saw me. "Well, look who's here. It's the yoga guru, paying us a rare visit. Welcome, honored sir." They showed me their teeth. I showed them my teeth. "We were discussing the elections, Country Mouse. You know, it's not like the darkness here. The elections aren't rigged. Are you going to vote this time?" I summoned him with a finger. He shook his head. "Later, Country Mouse. I'm having too much fun discussing the elections." I waved the brown envelope in the air. He put his cards down at once.
I insisted that we walk down to the parking lot. He counted the money there, in the shadow of the Honda City.
Good, Country Mouse. It's all here. And where is your master? Will you drive him there?
I am my own master.
He didn't get it for a minute. Then his jaw dropped. He rushed forward. He hugged me. Country Mouse! He hugged me again. My man!
He was from the darkness, too. And you feel proud when you see one of your own kind showing some ambition in life.
He drove me in the Qualis, his master's Qualis, to the hotel, explaining on the way that he ran an informal taxi service when the boss wasn't around. The hotel was in South Extension Part 2, one of the best shopping areas in Delhi. Vitiligo Lips locked his Qualis, smiled reassuringly, and walked with me up to the reception desk. A man in a white shirt and black bow tie was running his finger down the entries in a long ledger, leaving his finger on the book. He looked at me as Vitiligo Lips explained things into his ear. The manager shook his head.
A golden-haired woman? For him?
He put his hands on the counter and leaned over so he could see me from the toes up.
For him?
Vitiligo Lips smiled.
Look here. The rich of Delhi have had all the golden-haired women they want. Who knows what they'll want next?
Green-haired women from the moon? Now it's going to be the working class that lines up for the white women. This fellow is the future of your business, I tell you. Treat him well. The manager seemed uncertain for a moment. Then he slammed the ledger shut and showed me an open palm.
Give me 500 rupees extra, he grinned.
Working class surcharge.
I don't have it.
Give me 500 or forget it. I took out the last 300 rupees I had. He took the cash, straightened his tie, and then went up the stairs. Vitiligo Lips patted me on the shoulder and said,
Good luck, Country Mouse. Do it for all of us.
I ran up the stairs. Room 114A. The manager was standing at the door with his ear to it. He whispered,
Anastasia?
He knocked, then put his ear to the door again and said, Anastasia, are you in? He pushed the door open. A chandelier, a window, a green bed, and a girl with golden hair sitting on the bed. I sighed because this one looked nothing like Kim Basinger, not half as pretty. That was when it hit me, in a way it never had before, how the rich always get the best things in life. And all that we get is the leftovers. The manager brought both his palms up to my face. He opened and closed them, and then did it again. 20 minutes. Then he made a knocking motion with his fist, followed by a kicking motion with his shiny black boot.
Get it?
That's what would happen to me after 20 minutes.
Yes.
He slammed the door. The woman with the golden hair still wasn't looking at me. I had only summoned up the courage to sit down by her side when there was banging on the door outside.
When you hear that, it's over. Get it? The manager's voice. All right.
I moved closer to the woman on the bed. She neither resisted nor encouraged. I touched a curl of her hair and pulled it gently to get her to turn her face toward me. She looked tired and worn out, and there were bruises around her eyes, as if someone had scratched her. She gave me a big smile. I knew it well. It was the smile a servant gives a master.
What's your name? She asked in Hindi.
This one, too. They must have a Hindi language school for girls in this country, Ukraine, I swear.
Muna.
She smiled. That's not a real name. It just means boy.
That's right. But it's my name, I said.
My family gave me no other name. She began laughing, a high-pitched, silvery laugh that made her whole golden head of hair bob up and down. My heart beat like a horse's. Her perfume went straight to my brain.
You know, when I was young, I was given a name in my language that just meant girl. My family did the same thing to me.
Wow,
I said, curling my legs up on the bed. We talked.
She told me she hated the mosquitoes in this hotel, and the manager, and I nodded. We talked for a while like this, and then she said, "You're not a bad-looking fellow, and you're quite sweet," and then ran her finger through my hair. At this point, I jumped out of the bed. I said, "Why are you here, sister? If you want to leave this hotel, why don't you? Don't worry about the manager. I'm here to protect you. I am your own brother, Balaram Halway." "Sure," I said that. "In the Hindi film they'll make of my life. 7,000 sweet rupees for 20 minutes. Time to get started." That was what I actually said. I climbed on top of her and held her arms behind her head with one hand. Time to dip my beak in her. I let the other hand run through the golden curls. And then I shrieked. I could not have shrieked louder if you had shown me a lizard. "What happened, Mona?" she asked. I jumped off the bed and slapped her. "My, these foreigners can yell when they want to." Immediately, as if the manager had been there all the time, his ear to the door, grinning, the door burst open and he came in. "This," I shouted at him, pulling the girl by her hair, "is not real gold." The roots were black. It was all a dye job. He shrugged. "What do you expect for 7,000? The real thing costs 40, 50. I leapt at him, caught his chin in my hand, and rammed it against the door. "I want my money back." The woman let out a scream from behind me. I turned around. That was the mistake I made. I should have finished off that manager right there and then. 10 minutes later, with a scratched and bruised face, I came tumbling out the front door. It slammed behind me. Vitiligo lips hadn't waited. I had to take a bus back home. I was rubbing my head the whole time. 7,000 rupees. I wanted to cry. Do you know how many water buffaloes you could have bought for that much money? I could feel Granny's fingers wringing my ears. Back to Buckingham Towers at last, after a one-hour traffic jam on the road, I washed the wound on my head in the common sink and then spat a dozen times. To hell with everything. I scratched my groin. I needed that. I slouched toward my room, kicked open the door, and froze. Someone was inside the mosquito net. I saw a silhouette in the lotus position. "Don't worry, Balaram. I know what you were doing." A man's voice. Well, at least it wasn't Granny. That was my first thought. Mr. Ashok lifted up a corner of the net and looked at me, a sly grin on his face. "I know exactly what you were doing."
"Sir?"
"I was calling your name and you weren't responding, so I came down to see. But I know exactly what you were doing. The other driver, the man with pink lips, he told me." My heart pounded. I looked down at the ground. "He said you were at the temple, offering prayers for my health."
"Yes, sir,"
I said, with sweat pouring down my face in relief.
"That's right, sir."
"Come inside the net," he said softly. I went in and sat next to him inside the mosquito net. He was looking at the roaches walking above us. "You live in such a hole, Balaram."
"I never knew. I'm sorry."
"It's all right, sir. I'm used to it. I'll give you some money, Balaram. You go into some better housing tomorrow, okay?" He caught my hand and turned it over. "Balaram, what are all these red marks on your palm? Have you been pinching yourself?"
"No, sir. It's a skin disease. I've got it here, too, behind my ear. See? All those pink spots."
He came close, filling my nostrils with his perfume, bending my ear with a finger. Gently, he looked.
"My, I never noticed. I sit behind you every day, and I never..."
"A lot of people have this disease, sir. A lot of poor people."
"Really? I haven't noticed. Can you get it treated?"
"No, sir. The diseases of the poor can never get treated. My father had TB and it killed him."
"It's the 21st century, Balaram.
Anything can be treated. You go to the hospital and get it treated. Send me the bill. I'll pay it."
"Thank you, sir," I said.
"Sir, do you want me to take you somewhere in the city?" He opened his lips and then closed them without making any noise.
He did this a couple of times, and then he said, "My way of living is all wrong, Balram. I know it, but I don't have the courage to change it. I just don't have the balls." "Don't think so much about it, sir. And, sir, let's go upstairs, I beg you. This is not a place for a man of quality like yourself. I let people exploit me, Balram. I've never done what I've wanted. My whole life I..." His head sagged. His whole body looked tired and worn. "You should eat something, sir," I said. "You look tired." He smiled, a big, trusting baby's smile. "You're always thinking of me, Balram. Yes, I want to eat. But I don't want to go to another hotel, Balram. I'm sick of hotels. Take me to the kind of place you go to eat, Balram." "Sir, I'm sick of the food I eat, Balram. I'm sick of the life I lead. We rich people, we've lost our way, Balram. I want to be a simple man like you, Balram." "Yes, sir." We walked outside and I led him across the road and into a tea shop. "Order for us, Balram. Order the commoner's food." I ordered okra, cauliflower, radish, spinach and dal. Enough to feed a whole family, or one rich man. He ate and burped and ate some more. "This food is fantastic, and just 25 rupees. You people eat so well." When he was done, I ordered him a lassi, and when he took the first sip, he smiled. "I like eating your kind of food." I smiled and thought, "I like eating your kind of food too." "The divorce papers will come through soon. That's what the lawyer said." "All right. Should we start looking already?" "For another lawyer?" "No. For another girl." "It's too early, Mukesh. It's been just 3 months since she left. I had driven Mr. Ashok to the train station. The mongoose had come to town again from Dhanbad. Now I was driving both of them back to the apartment." "All right. Take your time. But you must remarry. If you stay a divorced man, people won't respect you. They won't respect us. It's the way our society works. Listen to me. Last time, you didn't listen. When you married a girl from outside our caste, our religion, you even refused to take dowry from her parents. This time, we'll pick the girl." I heard nothing. I could tell that Mr. Ashok was clenching his teeth. "I can see you're getting worked up," the mongoose said. "We'll talk about it later. For now, take this." He handed his brother a red bag that he had brought with him from Dhanbad. Mr. Ashok clicked open the bag and peered inside, and at once the mongoose slammed the bag shut. "Are you crazy? Don't open that here in the car. It's for Mukeshan, the fat man, the assistant. You know him, don't you?" "Yes, I know him." Mr. Ashok shrugged. "Didn't we already pay those bastards off?" "The minister wants more. It's election time. Every time there's elections, we hand out cash, usually to both sides. But this time the government is going to win for sure. The opposition is in a total mess. So we just have to pay off the government, which is good for us. I'll come with you the first time, but it's a lot of money. And you may have to go a second and third time, too. And then there are a couple of bureaucrats we have to grease. Get it? It seems like this is all I get to do in Delhi. Take money out of banks and bribe people. Is this what I came back to India for?" "Don't be sarcastic. And remember, ask for the bag back each time. It's a good bag, Italian made. No need to give them any additional gifts. Understand?" "Oh, hell, not another fucking traffic jam." "Balram, play Sting again. It's the best music for a traffic jam." "The driver knows who Sting is." "Sure. He knows it's my favorite CD. Show us the Sting CD, Balram. See? See? He knows Sting." I put the CD into the player. 10 minutes passed and the cars had not moved an inch. I replaced Sting with Enya. I replaced Enya with Eminem. Vendors came to the car with baskets of oranges or strawberries in plastic cases or newspapers or novels in English. The beggars were on the attack too. One beggar was carrying another on his shoulders, and going from car to car. The fellow on his shoulders had no legs below his knees. They went together from car to car, the fellow without the legs moaning and groaning, and the other fellow tapping or scratching on the windows of the car. Without thinking much about it, I cracked open the egg. Rolling down the glass, I held out a rupee. The fellow with the deformed legs took it and saluted me. I rolled the window up and resealed the egg. The talking in the back seat stopped at once. "Who the hell told you to do that?"
"Sorry, sir," I said.
"Why the hell did you give that beggar a rupee?
What cheek!
Turn the music off."
They really gave it to me that evening.
Though their talk was normally in a mix of Hindi and English, the two brothers began speaking in chaste Hindi entirely for my benefit. "Don't we give money each time we go to the temple?" the elder thug said. "We donate every year to the Cancer Institute. I buy that car that the school children come around selling. The other day I was speaking to our accountant, and he was saying, 'Sir, you have no money in your bank, it's all gone.' 'Do you know how high the taxes are in this country?" the younger thug said. "If we gave any money, what would we have to eat?" That was when it struck me that there really was no difference between the two of them. They were both their father's seed. For the rest of the drive home, the mongoose pointedly kept his eyes on the rear-view mirror. He looked as if he had smelled something funny. When we reached Buckingham B, he said, "Come upstairs, Balram."
"Yes, sir."
We stood side by side in the elevator. When he opened the door of the apartment, he pointed to the floor. "Make yourself comfortable." I squatted below the photo of Cuddles and Puddles and put my hands between my knees. He sat down on a chair and rested his face in his palm and just stared at me. His brow was furrowed. I could see a thought forming in his mind. He got up from his chair, walked over to where I was crouched, and got down on one knee. He sniffed the air. "Your breath smells of aniseed."
"Yes, sir."
"People chew that to hide the alcohol on their breath."
"Have you been drinking?"
"No, sir. My caste were teetotalers." He kept sniffing, coming closer all the time. I took in a big breath, held it in the pit of my belly, then I forced it out, in a belch, right to his face.
"That's disgusting, Balram," he said with a look of horror.
He stood up and took two steps back.
"Sorry, sir."
"Get out." I came out sweating. The next day I drove him and Mr. Ashok to some minister's or bureaucrat's house in New Delhi. They went out with the red bag. Afterwards, I took them to a hotel where they had lunch. I gave the hotel staff instructions. No potatoes in the food. Then drove the mongoose to the railway station. I put up with his usual threats and warnings. No AC, no music, no wasting fuel, blah, blah, blah. I stood on the platform and watched as he ate his snack. When the train left, I danced around the platform and clapped my hands. Two homeless urchins were watching me, and they laughed. They clapped their hands too. One of them began singing a song from the latest Hindi film, and we danced together on the platform. Next morning, I was in the apartment, and Mr. Ashok was fiddling with the red bag and getting ready to leave, when the phone began to ring. I said, "I'll take the bag down, sir. I'll wait in the car." He hesitated, then held the bag out in my direction. "I'll join you in a minute." I closed the door of the apartment. I walked to the elevator, pressed the button, and waited. It was a heavy bag, and I had to shift it about in my palm. The elevator had reached the fourth floor. I turned and looked at the view from the balcony of the 13th floor. The lights were shining from Gurgaon's malls, even in broad daylight. A new mall had opened in the past week. Another one was under construction. The city was growing. The elevator was coming up fast. It was about to reach the 11th floor. I turned and ran, kicking the door of the fire escape open, hurrying down two flights of dark stairs. I clicked the red bag open. All at once, the entire stairwell filled up with dazzling light, the kind that only money can give out. 25 minutes later, when Mr. Ashok came down, punching the buttons on his cell phone, he found the red bag waiting for him on his seat. I held up a shining silver disc as he closed the door. "Shall I play Sting for you, sir?" As we drove, I tried hard not to look at the red bag. It was torture for me, just like when Pinky Madam used to sit in short skirts. At a red light, I looked at the rear-view mirror. I saw my thick mustache and my jaw. I touched the mirror. The angle of the image changed. Now I saw long, beautiful eyebrows, curving on either side of powerful, furrowed brow muscles. Black eyes were shining below those tensed muscles, the eyes of a cat watching its prey. "Go on. Just look at the red bag, Balram. That's not stealing, is it?" I shook my head. "And even if you were to steal it, Balram, it wouldn't be stealing." "How so?" I looked at the creature in the mirror. "See, Mr. Ashok is giving money to all these politicians in Delhi so that they will excuse him from the tax he has to pay. And who owns that tax, in the end? Who but the ordinary people of this country?
You."
"What is it, Balram? Did you say something?" I tapped the mirror. My mustache rose into view again, and the eyes disappeared. And it was only my own face staring at me now. "This fellow in front of me is driving rashly, sir," I was just grumbling. "Keep your cool, Balram. You're a good driver. Don't let the bad ones get to you." The city knew my secret. One morning the president's house was covered in smog and blotted out from the road. It seemed as though there were no government in Delhi that day, and the dense pollution that was hiding the prime minister and all his ministers and bureaucrats said to me, "They won't see a thing you do. I'll make sure of that." I drove past the red wall of Parliament House. A guard with a gun was watching me from a lookout post on the red wall. He put his gun down the moment he saw me. "Why would I stop you?" "I'd do the same if I could." At night, a woman walked with a cellophane bag. My headlights shone into the bag and turned the cellophane transparent. I saw four large dark fruits inside the bag, and each dark fruit said, "You've already done it. In your heart, you've already taken it." Then the headlights passed. The cellophane turned opaque. The four dark fruits vanished. Even the road, the smooth polished road of Delhi that is the finest in all of India, knew my secret. One day at a traffic signal, the driver of the car next to me lowered the window and spat out. He had been chewing paan, and a vivid red puddle of expectorate splashed on the hot midday road and festered there like a living thing, spreading and sizzling. A second later he spat again, and now there was a second puddle on the road. I stared at the two puddles of red, spreading spit. And then the left-hand puddle of spit seemed to say, "Your father wanted you to be an honest man." But the right-hand puddle of spit seemed to say, "Your father wanted you to be a man." Mr. Ashok does not hit you or spit on you, like people did to your father. Mr. Ashok made you take the blame when his wife killed that child on the road. Mr. Ashok pays you well, 4,000 rupees a month. What do you save? Nothing. He has been raising your salary without your even asking. This is a pittance. You live in a city. I turned my face away from the red puddles. I looked at the red bag sitting in the center of my rear-view mirror, like the exposed heart of the Honda City. That day I dropped Mr. Ashok off at the Imperial Hotel, and he said, "I'll be back in 20 minutes, Balram." Instead of parking the car, I drove to the train station, which is in Paharganj, not far from the hotel. People were lying on the floor of the station. Dogs were sniffing at the garbage. The air was moldy. So this is what it will be like, I thought. The destinations of all the trains were up on a blackboard. Benares, Jammu, Amritsar, Mumbai, Ranchi. What would be my destination if I were to come here with a red bag in my hand? As if in answer, shining wheels and bright lights began flashing in the darkness. Now, if you visit any train station in India, you will see, as you stand waiting for your train, a row of bizarre-looking machines with red light bulbs, kaleidoscopic wheels and whirling yellow circles. These are your fortune and wait for 1 rupee machines that stand on every rail platform in the country. They work like this. You put your bags down to the side. You stand on them. Then you insert a 1 rupee coin into the slot. The machine comes to life. Levers start to move inside. Things go clankety-clank and the lights flash like crazy. Then there is a loud noise, and a small, stiff chit of cardboard, colored either green or yellow, will pop out of the machine. The lights and noise calm down. On this chit will be written your fortune and your weight in kilograms. 2 kinds of people use these machines: the children of the rich, or the fully grown adults of the poorer class, who remain all their lives children. I stood gazing at the machines, like a man without a mind. 6 glowing machines were shining at me, light bulbs of green and yellow and kaleidoscopes of gold and black that were turning around and around. I got up on one of the machines. I sacrificed a rupee. It gobbled the coin, made noise, gave off more lights, and released a chit. Lunar Scales Company, New Delhi, 110055. Your weight, 59. Respect for the law is the first command of the gods. I let the fortune-telling chit fall on the floor, and I laughed. Even here, in the weight machine of a train station, they try to hoodwink us. Here, on the threshold of a man's freedom, just before he boards a train to a new life, these flashing fortune machines are the final alarm bell of the rooster coop. The sirens of the coop were ringing, its wheels turning, its red lights flashing. A rooster was escaping from the coop. A hand was thrust out. I was picked up by the neck and shoved back into the coop. I picked the chit up and reread it. My heart began to sweat. I sat down on the floor. Think, Balram, think of what the buffalo did to his servant's family. Above me I heard wings thrashing. Pigeons were sitting on the roof beams all around the station. 2 of them had flown from a beam and began wheeling directly over my head, as if in slow motion. Pulled into their breasts, I saw 2 sets of red claws. Not far from me, I saw a woman lying on the floor with nice full breasts, inside a tight blouse. She was snoring. I could see a 1 rupee note stuffed into her cleavage, its lettering and color visible through the weave of her bright green blouse. She had no luggage. That was all she had in the world. 1 rupee. And yet look at her, snoring blissfully without a care in the world. Why couldn't things be so simple for me? A low growling noise made me turn. A black dog was turning in circles behind me. A pink patch of skin, an open wound, glistened on its left butt, and the dog had twisted on itself in an attempt to gnaw at the wound. The wound was just out of reach of its teeth, but the dog was going crazy from pain, trying to attack the wound with its slavering mouth. It kept moving in mad, precise, pointless circles. I looked at the sleeping woman, at her heaving breasts. Behind me the growling went on and on. That Sunday, I took Mr. Ashok's permission, saying I wanted to go to a temple, and went into the city. I took a bus down to Kutub, and from there a jeep taxi down to G.B. Road. This, Mr. Premier, is the famous red light district, as they say in English, of Delhi. An hour here would clear all the evil thoughts out of my head. When you retain semen in your lower body, it leads to evil movements in the fluids of your upper body. In the darkness, we know this to be a fact. It was just 5 o'clock and still light, but the women were waiting for me, as they wait for all men at all times of the day. Now, I've been to these streets before, as I've confessed to you, but this time was different. I heard them above me, the women, jeering and taunting from the grilled windows of the brothels, but this time I couldn't bear to look up at them. A pan maker sat on a wooden stall outside the gaudy blue door of a brothel, using a knife to spread spices on moist leaves that he had picked out of a bowl of water, which is the first step in the preparation of pan. In the small square space below his stall sat another man, boiling milk in a vessel over the hissing blue flame of a gas stove.
What's the matter with you? Look at the women.
The pimp, a small man with a big nose covered in red warts, had caught me by the wrist.
You look like you can afford a foreign girl. Take a Nepali girl. Aren't they beauties? Look up at them, son.
He took my chin. Maybe he thought I was a shy virgin out on my first expedition here, and forced me to look up. The Nepalis up there, behind the barred window, were really good-looking, very light-skinned, and with those Chinese eyes that just drive us Indian men mad. I shook the pimp's hand off my face.
Take anyone, take all. Aren't you man enough, son?
Normally this would have been enough for me to burst into the brothel hollering for blood. But sometimes what is most animal in a man may be the best thing in him. From my waist down, nothing stirred. They're like parrots in a cage. It'll be one animal fucking another animal.
Chew paan, it will help you if you're having trouble getting it up,
the seller of paan shouted from his stand. He held up a fresh, wet paan leaf and shook it so the droplets splashed on my face.
Drink hot milk, it helps too, shouted the small, shrunken man below him who was boiling the milk.
I watched the milk. It seethed and spilled down the sides of the stainless steel vessel. The small, shrunken man smiled. He provoked the boiling milk with a spoon. It became frothier and frothier, hissing with outrage.
I charged into the paan cellar, pushing him off his perch, scattering his leaves and spilling his water. I kicked the midget in his face. Screams broke out from above. The pimps rushed at me, shoving and kicking for dear life. I ran out of that street.
Now GB Road is in Old Delhi, about which I should say something. Remember, Mr. Premier, that Delhi is the capital of not one but two countries, two Indias. The light and the darkness both flow into Delhi. Gurgaon, where Mr. Ashok lived, is the bright modern end of the city, and this place, Old Delhi, is the other end, full of things the modern world forgot all about, rickshaws, old stone buildings, the Muslims. On a Sunday, though, there is something more. If you keep pushing through the crowd that is always there, go past the men cleaning the other men's ears by poking rusty metal rods into them, past the men selling small fish trapped in green bottles full of brine, past the cheap shoe market and the cheap shirt market, you will come to the great second-hand book market of Daryaganj. You may have heard of this market, sir, since it is one of the wonders of the world. Tens of thousands of dirty, rotting, blackened books on every subject. Technology, medicine, sexual pleasure, philosophy, education, and foreign countries heaped upon the pavement from Delhi Gate onwards all the way until you get to the market in front of the Red Fort. Some books are so old, they crumble when you touch them. Some have silverfish feasting on them. Some look like they were retrieved from a flood or from a fire. Most shops on the pavement are shuttered down. But the restaurants are still open, and the smell of fried food mingles with the smell of rotting paper. Rusting exhaust fans turn slowly in the ventilators of the restaurants like the wings of giant moths. I went amid the books and sucked in the air. It was like oxygen after the stench of the brothel. There was a thick crowd of book buyers fighting over the books with the sellers, and I pretended to be one of the buyers. I leapt into the books, picking them up, reading them like this, flip, 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 until a bookseller shouted, "You're going to buy it or read it for free?" "It's no good," I would say, and put the book down, and go to the next bookseller, and pick up something he had, and flip, 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 never paying anyone a single rupee, flipping through books for free. I kept looting bookseller after bookseller all evening long. Some books were in Urdu, the language of the Muslims, which is all just scratches and dots, as if some crow dipped its feet in black ink and pressed them to the page. I was going through one such book when a bookseller said, "Can you read Urdu?" He was an old Muslim with a pitch-black face that was bedewed with sweat, like a begonia leaf after the rains, and a long white beard. I said, "Can you read Urdu?" He opened the book, cleared his throat, and read,
You were looking for the key for years. Understood that?
He looked at me, wide furrows on his black forehead.
Yes, Muslim uncle.
Shut up, you liar, and listen.
He cleared his throat again.
You were looking for the key for years, but the door was always open. He closed the book. That's called poetry. Now get lost.
Please, Muslim uncle, I begged. I'm just a rickshaw puller's son from the darkness.
Tell me all about poetry. Who wrote the poem?
He shook his head, but I kept flattering him, telling him how fine his beard was, how fair his skin was.
Ha! How it was obvious from his nose and forehead that he wasn't some pig herd who had converted, but a true blue Muslim who had flown here on a magic carpet all the way from Mecca. And he grunted with satisfaction.
He read me another poem, and another one, and he explained the true history of poetry, which is a kind of secret, a magic known only to wise men. Mr. Premier, I won't be saying anything new if I say that the history of the world is the history of a 10,000-year war of brains between the rich and the poor. Each side is eternally trying to hoodwink the other side, and it has been this way since the start of time. The poor win a few battles, the peeing in the potted plants, the kicking of the pet dogs, etc. But of course the rich have won the war for 10,000 years. That's why, one day, some wise men, out of compassion for the poor, left them signs and symbols in poems, which appeared to be about roses and pretty girls and things like that, but when understood correctly, spill out secrets that allow the poorest man on earth to conclude the 10,000-year-old brain war on terms favorable to himself. Now the four greatest of these wise poets were Rumi, Iqbal, Mirza Ghalib, and another fellow whose name I was told but have forgotten.
Who was that fourth poet? It drives me crazy that I can't recall his name. If you know it, send me an email.
Muslim uncle, I have another question for you.
What do I look like? Your school teacher? Don't keep asking me questions.
The last one, I promise. Tell me, Muslim uncle, can a man make himself vanish with poetry?
What do you mean? Like vanish through black magic? He looked at me. Yes, that can be done. There are books for that. You want to buy one?
No, not vanish like that. I mean, can he...
The bookseller had narrowed his eyes. The sweat beads had grown larger on his huge black forehead. I smiled at him.
Forget I asked that, Muslim uncle.
And then I warned myself never to talk to this old man again. He knew too much already. My eyes were burning from squinting at books. I should have been heading back toward Delhi Gate to catch a bus. There was a foul taste of book in my mouth, as if I had inhaled so much particulated old paper from the air. Strange thoughts brew in your heart when you spend too much time with old books. But instead of going back to the bus, I wandered farther into Old Delhi. I had no idea where I was going. Everything grew quiet the moment I left the main road. I saw some men sitting on a charpoy, smoking, others lying on the ground and sleeping. Eagles flew above the houses. Then the wind blew an enormous gust of buffalo into my face. Everyone knows there is a butcher's quarter somewhere in Old Delhi, but not many have seen it. It is one of the wonders of the old city, a row of open sheds, and big buffalo standing in each shed with their butts toward you, and their tails swatting flies away like windshield wipers, and their feet deep in immense pyramids of shit. I stood there, inhaling the smell of their bodies. It had been so long since I had smelled buffalo. The horrible city air was driven out of my lungs. A rattling noise of wooden wheels. I saw a buffalo coming down the road, pulling a large cart behind it. There was no human sitting on this cart with a whip. The buffalo just knew on its own where to go, and it was coming down the road. I stood to the side, and as it passed me, I saw that this cart was full of the faces of dead buffaloes. Faces, I say, but I should say skulls, stripped even of the skin,
except for the little black bit of skin at the tip of the nose, from which the nostril hairs still stuck out, like last defiant bits of the personality of the dead buffalo. The rest of the faces were gone. Even the eyes had been gouged out. And the living buffalo walked on without a master, drawing its load of death to the place where it knew it had to go. I walked along with that poor animal for a while, staring at the dead, stripped faces of the buffaloes. And then the strangest thing happened, Your Excellency. I swear the buffalo that was pulling the cart turned its face to me and said in a voice not unlike my father's, Your brother Kishan was beaten to death. Happy? It was like experiencing a nightmare in the minutes before you wake up. You know it's a dream, but you can't wake up just yet. Your Aunt Lutu was raped and then beaten to death. Happy? Your grandmother Kusum was kicked to death. Happy? The buffalo glared at me. Shame, it said, and then it took a big step forward, and the cart passed by, full of dead-skinned faces, which seemed to me at that moment the faces of my own family. The next morning Mr. Ashok came down to the car, smiling, and with the red bag in his hand, he slammed the door. I looked at the ogre and swallowed hard. Sir, what is it, Balram? Sir, there's something I've been meaning to tell you for a while. And I took my finger off the ignition key. I swear, I was ready to make a full confession right there. Had he said the right word? Had he touched my shoulder the right way? But he wasn't looking at me. He was busy with the cell phone and its buttons. Punch, punch, punch.